So welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming this morning. Is there anybody, this is their first time here today? Okay. So things may not be totally understandable what we're up to, but hopefully over time they will be. And if you want, please stay for tea afterwards, and there'll be people downstairs, and you can answer any of your questions, why this and why that. What we do on Sundays, and again, everyone knows that we do have on Wednesday nights, an evening just devoted to both meditational practices, but all relating just simply to, not simply, it's quite profound, but to the path of mindful living and emotional healing. So that's every Wednesday night. But what we are working on here over these past months, actually since the fall, is this wonderful text called The Great Path of Awakening. These 58, 59 very pithy and meaningful directives that really incorporate the whole Buddhist path from beginning to end. So we are kind of in the middle of that, those of you who are just coming in, but hopefully it is all understandable. I'm looking at probably a very classical translation and text called The Great Path of Awakening, the classic guide to using the Mahayana Buddhist slogans to tame the mind and awaken the heart by a Tibetan teacher who's passed called Jamyang Kongtrul. But if you're interested in these mind trainings, they're called in Tibetan Lojong trainings, there are many good commentaries available. And in our community, we have what's called an intensive. There are about 75 people who are involved very deeply in the study and practice of this over these past months. There are seven main points, and these 58, 59 slogans under them. What I wanted to work on today was a very interesting section. So we've looked at what's called ultimate bodhicitta, the how to view the mind and the nature of reality from its deepest. We've looked at relative bodhicitta, which are all these wondrous practices of loving kindness and compassion, how to really live a happy life, many ways to go about that, and another key section, which is all about taking adversity as the path of awakening, which is a very profound teaching of these slogans, not to see adversity as adversity, but to see it as a possibility for transformation, and telling you exactly how to do this. But this next training, which has some points under it, it's a very interesting one. It's called The Extent of Proficiency in Mind Training. And whether you are a Buddhist or a non-Buddhist, a believer or a non-believer of any tradition or non-tradition, is there such a thing as proficiency? Or is this just something I do? Right? And it's interesting because we know that in other areas of our life, if we're learning something, the expectation is that we will be developing some competency in what we're learning, right? If we're training in a profession, there's the expectation that there'll be some standards of competency, some criteria of competency, that I'm kind of getting it and developing some skill in this area, right? Whether I'm a musician or a craft or really anything one's doing, cooking, if you think about it, there has to be some criteria that I'm becoming proficient, right? If my meals still taste terrible, you know, somebody's got to know that, especially me, if I keep, offering it to people. Is that clear? So we it's funny, I remember when I first got in the field of psychotherapy back in the 70s, there was very little criteria. for what it was about. Many people, they'd say, oh yeah, I've been in therapy for years. I love my therapist. You know, we have a great relationship. But there was never any sense like there was a reason to be in therapy, and somehow those issues that brought you to therapy were being transformed. You know what I'm saying? Like there was a reason to be there, other than to just have a good relationship with somebody or to enjoy yourself. That has changed, obviously, in these past years. But it's that kind of thing. I mean, like, you know, what am I, you know, people do these days, they, you know, they read all kinds of spiritual books and they do, you know, spiritual practices, even such a spiritual practice as what? Meditation, right? And they do all the other kinds of practices, mantras and visualizations and all kinds of stuff, right? But do I judge myself in terms of my proficiency is how I'm doing in those practices, right? Like, you know, is my concentration better? Is my mindfulness better? Am I able to, you see what I'm saying? Am I meditating daily? Is this a sign that I'm becoming more competent? You see, like the technology or the technique is how I'm judging my proficiency. Is you see what I'm getting at? Or is there a result? Right, so you may say, coming back to our cooking thing, you know, I've kind of mastered all the tools of cooking, right? I know how to fry, and I know how to sauté, and I know how to use a wok, and I know how to, you know, use an oven, and I, you see what I'm saying? I can follow directions, but is that the criteria of being a good cook? Right? You would say no. The criteria of being a good cook is the product is tasty, it's delicious, right? I mean, there's got to be something more than a mastery of technique. Is that clear? So this is the same, so he's saying, is there a criteria that if I am doing all these mind trainings in this book, or if I'm doing any kind of transformative work, is there a criteria that I know that I'm on the right path, that I'm getting somewhere? Is that clear? Other than I've just, you know, mastered the technique. So, the first training says, all dharma, which is, we could say, all spiritual practices, has a single purpose. And he says, this is Jamyang Kangchul commentarying on that. He says, since the purpose of all dharma both is simply to tame ego clinging, as you practice dharma or work at mind training, ego clinging should decrease. If your efforts do not counteract ego clinging, your practice is meaningless. Since this is the one criterion that determines whether dharma practice is effective or not, it is said to be the yardstick by which a dharma person is measured. Okay? So for those things, people say, well, you know, they read some Zen or they read some something. Well, isn't just everything, you know, just sitting, right? Isn't that the criteria, right? Just sitting in stillness, sitting without moving, sitting for hours, right? And if you've been around Zen people, they know how to sit for hours. You know, is that the criteria? I can say that because I've been a Zen person and am a Zen person. And no, so I'm speaking from experience. So, is that the criteria? You know, I can sit for an hour in full lotus, right? Is that the criteria? So here he says, no, the criteria is, one could say, you know that you are getting proficiency in dharma if you are less egocentric. Is that clear? The world is not based on I, me, mine. I do not enter all my experiences, all my relations, only concerned about myself. Right? If, no matter if how many years I've been doing meditation, how many years I've been involved in spiritual practice, my life still focuses around me, my needs, my wants, my desires, my pain, right? And that's all I'm focused on. then one can be a good meditator, right? But according to this, one is not becoming proficient in Dharma, what it's really about. This is profound, right? Because it not only, it really sets forth what this practice is about. It's not about technique, it's about what? The kind of person you want to be. The kind of person you are. And the kind of person you want to be and the person you are is something that unfolds in life. Not in some alternative spiritual reality, right? That we often fool ourselves with, you know, when we come to the meditation hall or when we're on our cushion or when we're engaged in spiritual conversations. Or, you know, it's like, wow, I'm really quite something these days. I'm actually becoming quite a spiritual person, if I say so myself. Is that clear? It's about something very else. It's through the, again, I am somebody who obviously, we have a meditation hall we're meeting in. Obviously, meditation is key. Mindfulness is key. You know, practice is key. But there has to be some way that we can evaluate, you know, what are the results? And the results are not here. The results are there in our life. Is that clear? What kind of person am I becoming? Right? Is the world less centered about me? Or the other way of saying it, am I more open to the world, to other people? Right? Do I at least care as much about the unhappiness, the suffering of others as I do about my own? Am I at least cognizant of the needs and the wants, the needs and the wants of others, especially people in my life, as I am of my own? Right? So if I'm still just focused on me, and in all my relationships my focus is on me, then I am, according to these standards, I am not becoming a person of Dharma. I am not somebody who's really, I may say I'm walking a spiritual path, but I'm really not. What's really happening, unfortunately, is myself, my ego, is walking a spiritual path. Is that clear? That's what's going on for many people. Right? And my ego, myself, has just taken on a new Dharma identity. But in truth, from the way I'm living my life from inside, I'm still running it on the old criteria. Right. So now we have a wonderful mirror, right, to look at ourselves. Right. And we know it because we are becoming softer people. The walls are coming down. We are more open to others, which means we are probably becoming more kind, more caring, more compassionate for others. We are learning to do for others as much as we do for ourselves. We are no longer focused on what everybody's doing for me, but I'm more focused on what I'm doing for others. You see, it's beginning to turn. I'm beginning to change. Right? I'm more patient. I'm less frustrated. Because when I'm impatient and I'm frustrated, it's because things aren't going whose way? My way. You see, that's all egocentricity. I just care about myself. When I'm frustrated in traffic, who do I care about? Do I care about everybody else who's caught in traffic? No. I just care about myself and where I got to get to, right? And the other 1,000 people caught in this traffic jam, they're just in my way. Do You see, that's like little, but it's the same disease, that we are living from, we are seeing everything through the chink of self, through the glasses of self, through the prism of self, and that is distorting everything. Okay. While Dharma has a single purpose, it is the reduction of self-cherishing, ego-clinging, egocentricity, self-centeredness, selfishness, right? All variations on a theme, but all talking about the same thing. So that's the first criteria that we are developing. Now again, this is not black and white, right? There's not like selfishness, selflessness, right? I mean, we could say on the continuum, it's a continuum, and there are people over here who are totally self-centered. What do we call those people? Yeah, we call them narcissists, right? We call them narcissists. Remember, narcissists, just looking in the water, in love with who? Remember, he saw his reflection in the water. He was just totally entranced. He had never seen such a beautiful thing in all his life. He couldn't take his eyes off it. He's looking at his own reflection. So that's one extreme, okay. And over here, I guess we have what? I don't know, Mother Teresa's, Dalai Lama's, Thich Nhat Hanh's, I mean, people who we know, and many people who are not celebrities or well-known, but people, the people who really totally live for others, right? Totally selfless. And each of us is somewhere along that continuum. Is that clear? And we may be more of it one day than another day, and we may be more of it in one situation than in other situations. But if we are practicing a spiritual path, a Dharma path, over the years, we should see some movement. Is that clear? For us to say, yeah, I am becoming more proficient in this. Now the second slogan. The second slogan says, of the two judges, rely on the principal one. And Jamin Kangchul says, for other people to see you as a Dharma person is one judge. But ordinary people do not know what is hidden in your mind and may just be taking joy in certain improvements in the way you act. One sign of proficiency in mind training is that there is never any shame or embarrassment about your state of mind. Consequently, do not be attached to the judgment of others, but rely principally on the judge of mind itself. So let me explain what he's getting at. He's getting something which kind of relates to what we just said about all Dharma has one purpose. So he says, of the two judges, rely on the principal one. And basically, the two judges are what? The external world, you know, everybody else who sees us, and us, me, right? Is that clear? And it's saying, of those, it doesn't say just ignore, I mean, everybody else, but it says, of the two judges, the one you need to really rely on is the internal judge. Now, why is that? Because others in the world only see our actions, right? And outwardly, some of our actions may look what? Good. But only we see inwardly. Only we see what's really going on in our minds. And we may just be acting good. Right? We just may be acting good because we want others to perceive us as good. We may be acting kind and compassionate and generous because we want other people to see us that way. Is that clear? But in our hearts, it's not coming from really within freely, right? We can be very philanthropic or generous, but it's all about what? Getting noticed, getting my name up, getting, you know, everybody know what a generous person I am. So it's just building ego, right? All these actions just build ego. I'm just manipulating, right? I'm acting this way because I want people to, you know, on a very personal level. I'm acting this way because I want people to like me. I'm acting this way because I want people to love me. I'm acting this way because I want people to think highly of me. I'm acting this way because I want people to think that I'm really a very intelligent, competent person, right? You see? Those are all actions which outwardly may appear,
what?
Good. But inwardly, the motivation is impure. Is that clear? The motivation is impure because it's just all about me. Right? And the truth is, the way I really am may be a distance from how I act in the world. Right? Now again, most of us do not have, and I'm sure we are quite happy, right, that most of us don't carry around speakers on our shoulders that are attached to our minds. Right? Can you imagine what that would be like? We laugh, but why is that? You see, he says, one sign of proficiency in mind training is that there is never any shame or embarrassment about your state of mind. How many people can say that? I mean, that's quite something, isn't it? That's why we laugh about, you know, speakers on our shoulders, because we would be deeply ashamed and embarrassed if people could hear what we were thinking. Is that clear? Which means that there's a part of us that knows that our actions, how we are behaving and how we are speaking to people, is not often a true reflection of what we're really thinking, is it? Do you see the discord? You see the lack of congruency between what's really going on inside us and how we present ourselves to the world? Now again, from a point of view of civil society, it's probably good that we don't have speakers. Because in terms of civil society, it is good to learn to contain a lot of these things and to act civilly to one another to preserve social harmony. Is that clear? But we're not talking about that. We're talking about an authenticity and a congruency within oneself, right? That again, we know the purpose, you know, the proficiency of Dharma practice is not based on how others perceive us. It is not based on how we appear to the world. The most important judge is ourselves, because only we, since we don't have speakers, only we, means each one of us, know what's going on in our minds. Is that clear? We're the only one who knows that. Nobody else can really see that. And so at the end of the day, who is evaluating my mind? And who is evaluating the purity of my actions, of my speech? It has to be who? Me. And it's important that the criteria that I'm using to evaluate me is based on some value. You know, based on some spiritual values of what we were just saying. You know, selflessness, of compassion, of loving kindness, of real caring for others, right? Not being always critical, judgmental. I mean, those are mind states that are not, those are not supportive of an open, loving, caring mind, is it? So it's very important. I mean, it's obviously important in the beginnings of spiritual practice to kind of get our behavior and our words in line, because that's obviously, you know, where we do most damage to others. But as we progress, there needs to be, you know, a lot of people stop there, right? A lot of what passes in this world for religious practice and spiritual practice stops there, right? We kind of gut it down. You see what I mean? We kind of gut it down. We know how to be involved in kind actions, good actions with others, and to speak. But yet, often inwardly, it's a very different story. And many people are satisfied with that bifurcation, that separation of how one presents oneself to the world and what's really going on inside us. It's the same way for suffering. You know, many, many people in our world suffer, don't they? And yet, you know, how you doing? Fine. How's everything going? Great. Isn't that the way we talk to each other? No. Because there's this unwillingness to be honest about what's really going on. Right? And that's like, the, you know, in a certain way, that's sort of like, in our culture, the elephant in the living room, right? Nobody wants to talk about it. Everything's fine. Everything's great. Oh, everybody's well. All is good. Thank you for asking. How's everything with you? Great. Right? So again, it doesn't mean you have to spill your heart to everyone, but at least there's an acknowledgement within yourself of the untruth of what you just said. Right? Yeah, I'm not really happy. Yeah, I'm really struggling these days. What's the truth? If we don't acknowledge that to ourselves, how are we ever going to change? How are we going to ever address the problem? Where's the energy going to come for transformation? If of the two judges, we are relying on the external judge, right? Because externally, we may what? Look good. Right? Externally, everything might be all right. Yeah. Got a job, got a decent place to live, my car's running, I'm in a relationship. Right? You see that? Everything's great. But those, again, all external. Can you see that's how we appear? The principle has to be, how am I really in my mind? What's really going on in there? And again, I'm not talking about you got to go around spilling your guts to everybody who dares ask you how you're doing, you know. But it also means an understanding that you know what you're doing, and with those who have meaningful relations with, you are open about that. It's the elephant in the living room. Why aren't we talking about that? I mean, where does pretending get us? Where does denial get us? I mean, that's what's so powerful about the Buddha's teaching, that, you know, in his Four Noble Truths, he talked about suffering and the cause of suffering before he got to nirvana, or the end of suffering, right? He was willing to acknowledge, yeah, you know, living in this world of mortality, everything is always changing, people get sick, people age, people die. I mean, it's like, you know, people lose what they love, people get what they don't want, people are in situations that they want to happen, they can't get out of situations they don't want to happen, right? Yeah, people, you know, there's a lot of suffering in this life, the Buddha said. I mean, he came out of denial. He lived in a culture when there was denial because everybody was what? If you've read the life of the Buddha, everybody was what? Partying. Right? And just, you know, everybody was young and youthful and having a good time and hunting and fishing and, right? Having parties at night and hanging out in pleasure gardens, right? It all looked good, didn't it? But the Buddha saw it doesn't last forever. These pleasures don't last forever. Youth doesn't last forever. Health doesn't last forever. Even our life doesn't last forever. Right? Good t- times don't last forever. Good times become bad times. Pleasure becomes pain. Coming together often leads to separation. So he noticed the other side, and he did something very unusual. He was willing to talk about it. And a lot of people went, when they heard him speak, they said, what? Well, he's right. See, he broke through the veil of illusion, the veil of denial. Was willing to speak the truth. Why was that? Because of the two judges, who was he relying on? His own experience, his own mind. Let me stop a second. All dharmas have a single purpose. Of the two judges rely on the principal one, and that first point I made about the extent of proficiency in mind training, this whole having some sense of criteria to one's spiritual life. Extent of proficiency in mind training, all dharma is a single purpose, of the two judges rely on the principal one. Any questions or comments? Don't be shy. If it doesn't make sense to you, or you have a question about it, or you see it differently, yes.
Thank you for your wonderful teaching. So I went back home and I saw some suffering in the city. And through my practice, I was able to let go of the ego pain to control out. And release that, let that go. And it was very peaceful. And I was able to approach my sister with openness and just be present to the suffering itself. My question is, what is a good way to be present to that suffering? For selfless reasons to allow healing or to be of service with another human being when they see that they're suffering, but they're in denial of the suffering.
So let me just repeat the question because it's being streamed. So the question relates to a specific incident with her sister, but basically saying, so when I get out of my own way and my own ego stuff about my sister, whatever dramas that I'm holding on to, whatever way I see her, want her to be, disappointed that she's not, when I finally let go of all that self-created stuff that I am laying on her, projecting on her, I see that she's suffering. Right? Well, right, now what happened? Yeah. Well, as you know, when we come out of our cocoon, when we come out of our narcissistic bubble, right? And again, we may think we're in the world, but if we're still seeing everything through our thoughts and our mental projections, we're not really seeing the world. We're just extending our cocoon onto everybody else. Is that clear? That's what most of us are doing. But when we kind of put that all down and we really see clearly, we just see simply, this is somebody who is suffering. Right? And just the same way when we are present to our own suffering, hopefully, when we really notice that we are suffering, we want to what? We want to alleviate our suffering. I mean, that's so normal, right? I mean, if there's a tack in our foot, do we keep walking? No, hopefully we are aware that our foot is suffering, and we stop, and we look, and we pull out the tack. Is that clear? Right? When I have an itch here, my right hand just naturally reaches over and scratches it. we might say that is an act of compassion, that my right hand is giving my left hand, my left arm. Is that clear? It's as simple as that. Right? Compassion means in the face of suffering, my own and someone else's, my natural instinct is, how can I be of help? How can I alleviate it? That comes from being present. Okay? Now, what do you do? Well, the one thing we can always do is just offer them our presence. And perhaps even acknowledge to them that they're suffering. It's like the elephant in the living room. You know, whether it's your own or people in your family, you know, rather than keeping the lie going, or that everything's all right, for somebody to say, yeah. You know, when you have a moment alone with her, it's not like, you know, around the dinner table or something. I mean, again, it's got to be skillful. You know, I can see you're suffering. And, you know, I'm sorry. That hurts me. Right? So that's one thing we can always do. Be present to another, right, in non-judgmental way, and to acknowledge that they're suffering, they're going through a hard time, there's some kind of pain, and you're aware of that. I mean, that is very healing in its own right. You know, for we know for each of us, unless we're totally defended and we're totally into the role and the, you know, of playing a role, that we are often quite moved when somebody sees us. Do you know what I'm saying? When somebody really goes, oh, you know, and sees us in an authentic way. It's quite a wonderful feeling, isn't it? So, you know, that's a good beginning. Now again, whether there's anything you can do really depends on the situation, the person. You know, it depends on, you know, are they interested in changing? Are they interested in being helped? Are they interested in you helping them? You know, right? So that's part of the deal. You know, a lot of times it's about, you know, do I have the skills? You know, I mean, it could be we don't have the skills based on what this person's going through. So there's, you know, the helping is, you know, different criteria. Do you see what I'm saying? But you know, at the very least, we can offer them our presence and our acknowledgement that they are suffering. Okay? Now, you know, for those who have been here a while and those who are in the intensive, there is this wonderful practice of exchange, what's called the tonglen, the giving and the taking, which is this meditative practice where you actually breathe in the suffering of another person and breathe out all the qualities that they need to end their suffering, which is a very powerful personal way that we don't feel necessarily, even if there's nothing we can do, actually, in our minds, we can always connect with their suffering, take it in, and in our minds, give. Like, your sister needs what? What would your sister need? I mean, I don't know what her suffering is, but if I mean, what would remediate her suffering? She would need what?
She needs support.
She doesn't have a lot of confidence in herself? Okay, so she needs confidence in herself. What else does she need? Think about if she, all the reasons she's suffering, what are the opposites of that? So she suffers because she has no confidence in herself. What else does she lack?
Patience.
Yeah, so you'd give her, if you find in yourself patience, you find that in yourself, you'd find confidence in yourself, you'd find patience, and you'd imagine that you're giving them to her. And there are perhaps other things. And so in the exchange, you're taking on her, you know, chronic self-doubt and lack of confidence in herself. You're taking on her impatience and you're giving her yours. Here, take it. It's like being generous, right? It's like, you know, we think of generosity as like money, you know, giving. I mean, generosity, giving money, is when there's a financial need, right? So we're generous by giving money because there's a financial need. But here it's a more personal, it's a more emotional need. So we have to have that same way, right, that we give. Right? Because we have other resources than money. Right? The generosity of finances is certainly good to be generous in that way. But in the teachings, generosity means also generosity in giving your presence, in giving yourself, in giving your time, in giving your energy to another human being. So there's many ways to be generous. Any other questions? Yes.
Rather than talking about practice, no matter what it is, you always start with yourself, right?
No.
Oh.
No. If you're doing it for yourself, you begin with yourself. If you're suffering and you imagine yourself in front of you, then it begins with you.
Okay.
But if it's beginning with someone else, you begin with their suffering. And then you take it into your heart. Now, if your heart is covered with its own self-cherishing, you imagine that you're letting go of that. But that's dissolving. Which happens naturally if you open to another person. So it's an alchemical process. Any other questions? Yes. Is it a little warm in here? Yes. Why don't we lower the AC? Yes.
Hi. I think I have a lot of fear.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that I'm driven by so many criteria. I feel like I'm bombarded on a daily basis with trying to get into these norms of you got to be pretty, you got to be smart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
I have 2.5 kids, and you need a lot of money, and you need a house.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm scared that if I let go of all those things and focus on being humble and what can I do for others,
mm-hmm.
I'm scared, what will I be?
Yeah. So that's a wonderful question. What's your name?
I'm Jessica.
Hey, Jessica. So that's a wonderful question. So Jessica says, I notice now that I'm present to myself, wow, I'm just fearful all the time, or a lot of the time, and I'm really overwhelmed with, that to be happy, I need to, be pretty and be successful and have 2.5, how many kids? 2.5 these days. That could be a little high for these days. But I got to be all these things. So if I asked you, Jessica, is everybody who is pretty and has 2.5 kids and has a good job, are they all happy? No. Okay. So again, to have any goals or objectives for your life, that's fine, right? But to see those goals and objectives as your path to happiness, that's totally distorted, right? Because based on that, the more you have, the happier you'd be. But we know that's not true, right? Wow. You practice, right? That's what this is all about, right? You wake up one day and you acknowledge that all that hard work you're doing is just getting you stressed out and anxious, and it's not producing happiness, right? That's like the Buddha. That's where he began. You begin by willing to acknowledge that actually it may be contributing to my unhappiness. Well, that's interesting, right? Not only is it not delivering happiness, well-being, peace of mind, but actually that process of wanting more and needing more and feeling that I can only be worthy if I get more, blah, 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 is only making me more miserable, okay? So that's the beginning, right? That's called coming out of denial, right? And being honest and listening to what were we just talking about? The primary, right? You've always listened to the one outside, and you haven't listened to the primary. Now you're listening to the primary, and you hear she's got a very different message for you than that one. Okay, now it's a matter of, what can you do? And again, it's not about you have to, you know, not having a job or not having a family. I mean, if you, you know, if that's your path in life, you know, that's wonderful. You see what I'm saying? It's not about that. Or if it's not, it's not about that. Really, the real issue is, you know, that Thich Nhat Hanh says, you know, practice is about learning to be happy in the present moment. Right? He doesn't say learning to be happy if you're pretty and have a good job and have 2.5 kids. You see, it's about, have I learned within my own mind and heart how to cultivate happiness, peace of mind, well-being, as an internal, you see, as an internal condition. That's not based on an external situation. Because what you just said is, you know, that just getting all those things will not produce what you want, will it? So again, it doesn't mean one doesn't, you know, in life go after things if one wants to, but one doesn't go after them with that sense of desperation. Right? Like somehow, if I don't get that, it's the end of the world or my life's ruined. Because we know, as many people who have all those things, their life is ruined. Isn't that the truth? Yeah, so we have to be wise, right? And not be fooled. Right? There are a lot of forces in our society that are trying to fool us. Right? Be part of the Pepsi generation and everything will be what? Happy, just good times come in a can. And then you get a little older, good times comes in, you know, an alcoholic beverage, right? Right? You know, you drive down 275, you see all those big ads, right? Good times, all about drinking. Right? Is that true? That's what they're selling. Right? And they're selling it all over the place, right, aren't they? Yeah. This will make you happy. This will make you happy. This will make you happy. Get this, get that, do this, do that, then you'll be happy. Right? Is that true? See, nobody ever asks, is that true? You know, those are called follow-up studies. You know, like, you know, does anybody come to that person 5 years later and go, oh, you know, did buying that brand new car that made you so happy 5 years ago, are you still as happy as with that, you know? And you go, gee, I haven't even thought about that car. You know, it's like, no. Yeah. I mean, that happiness lasts about 4 days. Right? So we need to think intelligently about this life. I mean, that is why in Buddhism, our analytical facilities of mind is considered wonderful. You see, most people go, you know, I'd like to shoot this guy, right? Or you know, our minds are kind of driving us crazy. I'd like to get rid of him. But actually, this mind and its capacity to look deeply, right, and to see our situation and to come up with alternatives, you know, rabbits can't do that, right? Bumblebees can't do that. Birds can't do that, right? That is a great gift of the human mind, that we have this wonderful thing called intelligence that has the capacity of turning into wisdom, but it has to be developed in the right way. In our society, what are the smartest people doing? So the so-called smartest people. They're doing what? Finding new ways to make money. Isn't that right? I mean, that's what our society is about. Right? Let's get the most intelligent people and let's put them in the pursuit of making more money. As if what? As if all the money we've made already isn't enough? Right? I mean, why isn't all the money we've made enough to produce happiness?